Okay, I think it's recording.
First of all, I'd like to welcome you guys. Thanks for sharing my birthday with me. Before we begin, let's bring it down and let's dedicate our learning tonight and our discussion to the hostages, to their families, to our soldiers and their families, and to our nation. And may our happiness increase this month.
Amen.
God willing. Amen. Okay. Our speaker is Shoshana Keats-Jaskel. And I have known Shoshana for many years. We've worked together on several marketing and web design projects. And as you will find out, she's quite accomplished. And I have felt great pride in knowing her as a friend, as I've watched her gain her strength and influence as an advocate for Israel and for Jewish women worldwide, but really here in Israel, like to the heart of it. Shoshana is an American Israeli writer and activist. She's a grandchild of survivors, and she has taught her to never be a bystander in life. She uses her pen, but actually it's her keyboard, to tell Israel's story in traditional and social media. She's a co-host of The Quad on JNS, and Shoshana also speaks about current events and battles the rampant anti-Israel misinformation. As co-founder of Chokhmat Nashim, which means women's wisdom, she balances the need to defend Israel and the Jewish people with the responsibility to make the community as healthy as it can be by fighting religious extremism. And she has some references that I put in at the announcement earlier with websites. Of real orthodox, extremism and the marginalization of women. She has a stock photo bank, of real orthodox women and their families, and she raises representation of orthodox women through this. Also through ratemybeitdin.com, she gives voice to the community to improve the rabbinic court system where too many women find themselves chained to dead marriages. Her work can be found in the Times of Israel, Jerusalem Post, UK Jewish Chronicle, and more.
That's all?
No, there's more. She writes in these places. She writes about Judaism, women's issues, and Israel. Please welcome Shoshana.
Thank you. Thank you, Allison. Yes, Allison's wonderful. I don't think I have to tell everyone in the room, but I will confirm it for everyone in the room. Can you see me? Is it okay if I sit?
Yeah.
You want me to stand up?
Sit.
Do you want to sit here? There's a plush, cushy couch right here.
There's seats up front.
Thank you. Usually I stand, but I happen to have twisted my knee. So I do appreciate if I can sit for at least some of the time. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. I appreciate it. I think we found who's in charge.
Okay, thank you.
Feel comfortable.
Thank you. I feel very comfortable and relaxed. I feel like this is a lovely crowd. I would also like to just ask if we could dedicate tonight to a very good friend of mine who's very sick. For Refuah Shleima to Ariella Panina Bat Tzivia Etel. She should have a Refuah Shleima and stay with us for a very long time.
Thank you.
She also happens to be a board member of Chokhmat Nashim and one of my star photographers. But first and foremost, she's a soul sister of mine whom I love very much. Okay. Let's see, I'm going to reference the stuff on my phone because as I told Allison when I walked in and as I mentioned to you, I hurt my knee and my office is about 30 stairs down and then 30 stairs back up. So I didn't bring the things that I usually bring. You'll forgive me and hopefully we'll be able to do this without my props. I was born in Lakewood, New Jersey. Which is a Ir HaKodesh. As long as we know we're in the same crowd, okay.
Yeah. Ir HaKodesh. I don't know if too many people know about Lakewood, I do.
Okay, so Lakewood was a very eclectic town. We had Jews, non-Jews. I went to public school. I did both back and forth. I went to Jewish school and public school, and the public school at the time was 80% minority. Yes. I was actually a minority, and I just grew up with all types of people, and it didn't matter to me who, what, where, and when. As long as you were a good person, that's right. where we were at. So my grandparents were survivors, and they did teach me never to be a bystander. They gave me a tremendous Jewish soul, and we would say good Shabbos. I wasn't religious growing up, but we would say good Shabbos to whoever we saw on Shabbat. Whatever you are wearing or not wearing on your head, whatever you're wearing on or not wearing on your legs. And my mother's first language was Yiddish. Okay. So she would talk to Rav Cutler, Zatzal, the original Rav Cutler, in his, you know, black and white, and they would just speak in Yiddish as she's in her jeans, and it didn't matter.
So you would not understand.
But that's what I'm saying. Well, I understood, but I couldn't speak it.
Yes,
but meaning that's what it was back then. There was a lot less judgment. It was we weren't as divided as we are now. So fast forward, I made Aliyah three times. The last time to Beit Shemesh. Beit Shemesh. And if you, what do you know about Beit Shemesh? Raise your hands.
I have two grandsons in law.
Okay, not everyone knows that about Beit Shemesh. That would be,
Which part?
I lived there for 27 years.
Okay, so what do you know about Beit Shemesh?
It's become very
Haredi. Yeah, well, yes. Yes, Haredi, but it's also where...
Well, it was meant to be a mixed city.
It was meant to be a mixed city. It was a mixed city. And basically, they took all the people who were way too extreme for Mea Sharim and dumped them right in the middle of a Tzioni, very eclectic group of Russian and Ethiopian and American. Well, it didn't wind up so good because they wanted to tell us what we should be doing and do it far away from them. So to make a long story short, I was witness to a lot of extremism in the name of the Judaism that I love. Mm-hmm. I chose to become religious. I wasn't born religious. My parents weren't religious. They aren't religious. And I fell in love with Judaism. And to see someone speaking Yiddish, which was the language of my grandparents, and spitting on me and calling me a shiksa, was a little bit too much for me to handle.
Goyim shiksa.
Shiksa, yeah. It was a little bit much for me, and I couldn't keep quiet. At the same time that this was going on, my daughters were told to sit in the back of the bus because that's where girls belong.
Oh, wow.
I was told that once too. I'm carrying a safer bus, and I told them to enjoy it. I'll stay where I am.
One time.
What year is that? And my daughters are my daughters, and even at 7 and 10, did not go to sit in the back of the bus, but they did come home and they told me about it. And this was the year 2012.
My mother in the 1950s went to Texas. First time she saw blacks in the back of the bus.
Yes.
And she sat in the back of the bus.
Wow. Isn't that what we do nowadays, guys?
Yeah.
And my aunt, or actually my husband's aunt.
Excuse me.
That's okay. My husband's aunt at the time was being denied a divorce. Okay, if there's any phrase or terminology that I use that you don't know, just raise your hand and I'll translate it. But she was denied a get, right? She. I love it. I love it. Who do you think you are not answering your door? I don't understand. Oh, Shoshana. Sorry, Shoshana. Yeah.
Where do you live now?
We just moved out of Beit Shemesh to Gvot Eden, which is 12 minutes and a world away from Beit Shemesh. It's between Beit Shemesh and the Gush. Yeah.
Do you call yourself a Beit Shemesh refugee? Like?
I hadn't until now. I might steal that from you.
Welcome to the club.
There's a lot of us around.
Yeah.
So my aunt was being denied a divorce, but she was back in Muncie raising the five kids.
Oh.
And he, like all good Jewish criminals, moved to Israel. Well, Muncie. She was in Muncie. And he moved to Israel because he was originally British, but he had broken a lot of American laws, tax evasion, fraud, you know, those types of things. And then after he got out of jail, he was deported and he went to Israel. So I was living here with my husband and kids, and she asked me to help her get her get. Now, I literally knew nothing about what this the whole get situation is. And this is something, by the way, we as Jewish women need to be discussing a lot more. Why don't we know what we're getting into when we walk down the aisle? When we dance our children down the aisle, do we know what we're doing with them? Do we tell them what they're entering? Now I do. But when I was getting married, I didn't know what a prenup was, a get was. I didn't know what an aguna was. Aguna is what we call a woman who is chained in marriage. Now, traditionally, that means that her husband was missing. He went on a business trip and they haven't heard from him since. Because back then, ships went down. And pirates and brigands and all those things that we read about existed.
Yeah.
Now, not so much. If a guy is refusing to give a divorce, we call her an aguna, even though actually she is a misorevet get, which means that someone who is being denied a get, which means there is an active participant who is doing the denying. Okay, we'll get into that in a minute. So I know tonight we're supposed to talk about agunot. Why? Because Tanis Esther is Yom HaAguna. Tanit Esther is a fast of Esther. Anyone know why maybe they made the fast of Esther International Aguna Day, if an aguna is someone who's chained to a marriage?
Well, I imagine because Esther was kind of stuck married to
it. Esther was stuck married to Achashverosh. She didn't want to be in that marriage, but she didn't have any choices. So it was, I think, 20, 25 years ago, they made Tanit Esther, the fast of Esther, into Yom HaAguna, the day that we remember the women who are chained in marriage. So it's appropriate to discuss this a few weeks before Purim. So, as I said, this was occurring at the same time. My community was experiencing extreme extremism, okay? And at the same time, my aunt was being denied a divorce. Now, she asked me for help, so I'm like, okay, I figured I'm just going to go into the Beit Din for her. Beit Din is a rabbinical court. In Israel, there's no civil divorce. We know that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So I figured I'd go into the court for her, I would represent her side, and she would get a divorce from the man who left her and her five children. Oh. Why is this difficult? Well, 7 years later. It took me 7 years. And not only did it take me 7 years, but we went all the way up to the chief rabbis. Wow. Rav Avadi Yosef was chief rabbi at the time, and Rabbi David Lau. At the time, was, and it was actually, Rav Avadia said, I'm skipping a lot of this story because it's not the important part, but I need you to understand where I am and how I got to where I am. Rav Avadia said, she should be free. But then, I don't know if you remember, he fell, went to the hospital, and never came out. And he never wrote it down. But I had been speaking to his daughter, Adina, Rabbanit Adina, Bar Shalom, who said, don't worry, my brother is going to be the next chief rabbi. And he'll take care of it. So he did become the next chief rabbi. But he did not take care of it. It was like we never existed. And so I really felt at this moment a real crisis of faith. A real crisis of faith. I have a chief rabbi who's pretending he doesn't know who I am when his sister was telling him, dad, literally, Abba told him, told us to take care of it. And this is years in the making. And I decided, you know, or I realized I could either step up or just step away. Like, I either try to make a change with this thing that I love, or I just say, forget it. Like, what am I going to, me with Muhammad in the mountain, or it's me in City Hall, whatever metaphor you want to use, like, what am I going to do? And I guess probably my grandparents again are to thank for this, that I just don't give up. I don't have that in me. And I will say that when you love something, you don't give up on it.
Exactly.
Right? Like, I love 99.97% of my husband. I'm not giving up on him because the part that's crappy, you know what I'm saying? He's not crappy. He's wonderful. But I'm just saying, to use an analogy, I wouldn't walk away from him because of the part that gets hard. Right?
Yes.
As hard as it might be, when it's hard, I love almost everything else. So
absolute love.
So absolute, unconditional love.
Unconditional.
And so I unconditionally love Hashem and the Torah, and I felt like, okay, so maybe I'm put here for a reason.
Yeah.
It's not me. Mishra. I'm not the one suffering, right? My aunt is. So I'm from a position of strength. I have a strong home. I have my husband at home. I'm not financially strapped because someone took my money. Maybe this is why I'm here.
Yes.
So I have to just woman up. Right? So I womaned up, and I met so many amazing people who are fighting this battle. So many amazing people. I'm the Voice of Tome and E-Team, and just these are the organizations run by amazing people who work in different ways for the Aguna problem, as they call it. So what's really the problem when it comes to Agunot? Let's just dig in for a second. In Judaism, marriage isn't a partnership that is 50-50 on paper.
No.
Okay? No. The man has the power. He, first of all, I don't want to say he buys, because it's not really a buying as much as it's a contract where he brings you, he takes possession, he brings you into the home, and he's obligated to give you certain things, right? There's certain things, hopefully you all know where your ketubah is. So, I mean, not that it will help you so much if you, God forbid, need a divorce, but you should know where it is. He's sexual relations, shvud and shelter, and clothing. He has to take care of that.
What a ketubah is.
A ketubah is the, thank you, is the contract that a man and two witnesses sign before you walk down the aisle. Okay? And it basically lays out the fact that this woman and this man are getting married. He has to do this and this for her. And if he divorces her, he has to give her X, Y, and Z.
What is it?
It depends. Usually it's an amount of money. Right, amount of $50,000 or shekel or whatever it is, depending. But there's like a standard fee. Or it's sheep and goats, depending on which version you use.
I ask for camels.
Whiskey. I mean, whiskey. Single malt only. And so when you get married in a chuppah, this is the contract that makes you married. Now, a woman doesn't sign it. She only, what's the only part in the ceremony? She accepts the ring. She accepts the ring.
But she takes possession of the ketubah too?
Yes, well, the ketubah is hers. That's her proof that she can't be tossed out. Okay? In the Torah itself, a man can give her write her bill of divorce, give it to her, and walk away.
Whoa.
That is halacha misinai. Like, that's what he's allowed to do. Comes Rabbeinu Gershom 1,000 years ago and says, no. This is not happening. This is disrespectful to Benos Yisrael because these guys are getting a little crazy and this is what they're doing. So you can't divorce a woman without her consent. That was done about a little over 1,000 years ago by Rabbeinu Gershom. By the way, only Ashkenazi. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sephardim have kind of picked it up, but it was only Ashkenazi for a while. So basically, at this point, a woman cannot be divorced without her consent. However, she doesn't have the right to sue for divorce, unless there are certain criteria that are met. Okay, we're kind of getting a little deep into the halacha, which I don't really want to do so much because it's a little complicated. But the bottom line is, a woman has to prove in a court that she has a reason for divorce. Now, the dayanim, the judges, are supposed to just listen to her and hear that she says, "I don't want to be with this person anymore." You could say for whatever reasons, he doesn't treat me right, okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's what they're supposed to do, and then they're supposed to facilitate. What happens is, when the man says, "No, I don't want to give you a divorce," or, "Sure, I'll give you a divorce.
Give me
$50,000. Give me the kids. Don't take child support." And this is when it becomes very, very ugly. Because, unfortunately, as we know, when tools of abuse are on the table, and I had a conversation with a very secular friend of mine, completely secular, like, you know, Jewish but secular. And he goes, "You know, Shoshana, when I got divorced, I never in a million years thought I would refuse a get. I never would do such a thing." He said, "But you know, when you get into that mode of yours and mine, and we're on the opposite side of the table, and you see it as a tool for yourself." He said, "And I really, really contemplated it. And my lawyer said, why don't you just say no until you get what you want? And it was ugly, and I didn't want to see that side of myself, so I just signed right away." But it is tempting. Thank you. It's tempting when you're angry, when you're hurt, when you're embarrassed, when you're ashamed. And we, the community, have to know that tools like tools of abuse should not be available to those who are in a vulnerable, painful, angered position. Right? That's what Jews are supposed to do to protect each other. So there are a lot of safeguards that the Jewish community have tried to put into play, like the halachic prenup, which I can explain if people want to know more. But at the end of the day, we are still a very traditional society. Mm-hmm. And we are a very patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I'll say to you is, if you have any children getting married, or friends, or family, or whatever, have them sign a halachic prenup, which I'm happy to give you resources about. It's a great document that basically just says, I had my kids sign it. My son got married, and I told him, maybe my kids know. My 12-year-old knows that he's signing a halachic prenup when he gets married. There's no... I'm going to explain it. So a prenup is a prenuptial agreement, an agreement that you sign before you get married. Halachic is Jewish law. So this is a prenup that doesn't deal with money, it doesn't deal with property, it only deals with the end of the marriage. So it says, for example, if one spouse decides that they want out of this marriage, then the other spouse can ask for therapy, marital therapy, for 6 months or 9 months, depending on the version of this document. There's a few people that have put together their own versions. After 6 to 9 months, if that first spouse says, I still want a divorce, I, the second spouse, commit to not saying no. I commit to granting the divorce. So both parties sign it, and it's really a beautiful show of, I'm going to protect you from my worst self. Like, it's like a seatbelt or a vaccine. I hope we don't have any anti-vaxxers here. But it's like an insurance policy that you never want. So my son and my daughter-in-law are sitting down to read it and sign it, and my son looks at me and goes, "This is not fun. This isn't nice." I go, "Okay, okay, but the fun part's coming soon, and then you'll have fun for the rest of your life. You just have to sign this. I'll keep it in my safe deposit box, even though it's my daughter-in-law, he's my son, but I'll hold it for her. And that's it, you don't have to worry about it. You're doing," and my daughter was like, "I think it's so nice." So, I mean, they signed it and they forgot about it promptly. Now, I should point out that this is a document that helps with get refusal, meaning someone actively saying, no, I won't give it, or no, I won't receive it, because the woman can refuse. 90% of the time, it's the man who's refusing, in my experience, and I'll go into my experience soon. There is another document that can save a spouse, generally the woman, from, God forbid, if a man is actually disappears or is in some sort of coma. So there's a very famous case of a woman whose husband was in a terrible motorcycle accident, and he was brain dead, and he was literally only alive by a machine. If you pulled the plug, she would be a widow. She was kept an aguna for, I believe it was 5 years. Because he was not functional, but he couldn't give her a divorce, and he was still alive. So they wouldn't. So brave, brave, brave rabbis in Haifa, I believe, used. I'm sorry?
Yes. Rabbi Shari Yishuv Cohen?
I don't think so. I think it was...
I'll
remember it when I'm not thinking of it. Mm-hmm. Don't hold me to it.
3:00 in the morning.
I'll text Allison.
And I'll be sure and pass it on.
Yeah.
That
I think Levi. I think Levi.
Not Cohen, but Levi.
Yeah, not Cohen, Levi. The other, yeah. But wait, there's actually a tragic, well, not tragic, but very sad end to the story. So he basically gave her... He gave her a get by saying, if this man had been conscious, if he was conscious and knew the situation, he would want to give his wife a get, and he gave her what's called a get zikui, which I think there's no other ones in the world. He used this halachic tool that usually it's used, like, if let's say your friend isn't religious, and you want to sell their chametz for him, because he won't care, and you want to help him do a mitzvah. So halachically, you're allowed to do it for his zikui, like in his chut, like in his merit, yeah. So he uses this halachic thing, I'm doing it for him because it's a mitzvah that he can't do for himself, da-da-da, and he gives her the thing. The whole world goes bananas, and when I say the whole world, I mean the Rabbanut, including the current chief Sephardi rabbi, or the one just went out, and tried to undo this get. Tried to reverse this woman's freedom. Oh. And that the guy, who I'm pretty sure was Levi, was demoted and sent to like Yemensville.
Wow.
So they tried to reverse the get, and I was in the Supreme Court, okay, when Batya Kahana Dror of Mavoi Satum took the Rabbanut to court and said, if they reverse this get, then every single get that has ever been given is in jeopardy. Mm-hmm. And what if she's remarried? And what if she has kids? What, are you going to reverse it and make mamzerim? This is not an option. Halakhically, you cannot do that.
What?
In the end...
No, I know. Sorry. Not the terms, just what... Just
okay,
like
if, let's say this woman got remarried.
Yeah. After she was given the get.
After she was given the get, thank you. And she has children. And then they go and retroactively say, no, that get wasn't kosher. So now her current marriage isn't kosher, and her children are mamzerim. Because
but didn't they try to reverse it before?
Well, she was already dating at this point because it was lasted months and months and months, the whole thing. So they failed.
I thought halakhically you're absolutely, once a get is given, you're absolutely correct. Not allowed to question
it. But it wasn't
it,
a get.
They aren't.
It wasn't a regular type of get.
But it was.
You are correct. A Beit Din should not and cannot reverse a get. But... there is like the stipulation that if there's like a Sanhedrin kind of situation and they see something that happens, they can overturn it. But the Rabbanon is not the Sanhedrin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they lost. They lost.
We lost.
Which is great.
They did not reverse it. Okay.
But I think we need to understand how precarious our situation is, right? It's everybody wants their children to be in the chuppah. It's the most natural thing in the world. Jewish families, kinderlach. I mean, this is who we are. And yet we have to understand that there are people who are not well. And even people who are well, some things happen to them sometimes. And I could tell you an amazing story. A friend of mine, her daughter was dating someone she did not like. She was like red flags all over the place. But her daughter was in love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she said, okay, you want to marry him? Mm-hmm. You can marry him. You're going to sign a halachic prenup. Well, the document that we were just talking about. So they're like, sure, we'll sign it, sure. Comes 2 weeks before the wedding, mm-hmm. and they sit the parents down and they say, we're not signing. My friend picks up the phone, calls the caterer, cancels the whole wedding. Cancels the wedding. What happens? Guy goes home that night, takes all the engagement gifts they got, cleaned out the apartment, and left.
Wow.
She saved her daughter 100% because she refused to let her marry him without this prenup. It takes a lot of guts, and her daughter hated her for a long time, but she's safe, she's fine, and now she understands that her mother saved her. Okay? These are real stories. These are not stories I'm telling you that I've heard. I know these people, personally. It took me years to get my aunt her divorce. And years after that, for her to get the... So you get the get, and then they tear it up. Why do they tear it up? So that nobody can question it, like you said. But what happens, you have to have a certificate of divorce in order to prove that you're divorced so you can get married again. So they didn't give her the certificate of divorce because her ex-husband was playing games left and right. So it took 3 years. We got the certificate of divorce, and they still won't publicize my aunt's case because it was so messed up. I firmly believe at this point, being able to look back 2020, that I'm here for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I've learned so much about Judaism, about marriage, about divorce, about politics, about...
people.
Yes, and
the
yes.
real life.
All of the above. And, you know, people ask me a lot of times, like, you know, like, how do you like, speak out against the Rabbanut? Like, how do you speak out?
You should.
And I say, you know... For me, you have to be able to delineate what is Torah and what is cultural. What is halacha and what is societal? Because it's certainly not halacha to put women in the back of the bus. And it's certainly not halacha to keep a woman chained to a man who's living with a non-Jewish woman in China, which my aunt's ex-husband was doing. So once you see that you are Dafka, the one standing up for Torah values, you are the one who is standing up for justice, it really gives you the strength and the backbone to do so. And there's a lot of other wonderful people doing it. I started writing about all the things we were experiencing. I started when Times of Israel, someone mentioned, where else do you... Times of Israel back then would just open their blogs. So I was like one of the first people to have a blog. Somebody else happened to sign me up for it. And I thank God it was there because it gave me an outlet to start talking about the things that I was seeing. And if you want to look it up, it's called The Hijacking of Judaism, Its Victims and Consequences. And I spoke about everything that I was seeing. Women being erased from advertisements. That's a whole nother speech I can give you. in the back of the bus, being spit on, not being refused a representation. And I wrote about it, and people were writing to me, but not just from Beit Shemesh, from London and New York and Argentina and all these places that had Jewish communities, and they were saying, you know, we see this extremism also. What do we do about it? And I realized, I'm not just talking about myself. Like, here I think I'm just like, you know, kind of like venting a little bit and like getting it out. But no, I'm really speaking for so many, mostly women, but also men who are devastated to see what's happening to Judaism. And so, long story short, I wound up getting together with another six women, and we started writing a lot. Now, back then, are you timing me? Because I am not timing me.
No, keep going. Okay. Keep going. Nobody's
getting answers. Okay. Okay. Do you know what yoetzot halacha are? Okay, so yoetzot halacha, for those who don't know, is someone who's able to help women navigate the family purity laws, taharat hamishpacha, you know, around menstruation and going to the mikvah and all that stuff. So I'm old enough to remember that we didn't have those women. We had to give our underwear to rabbis. I don't know where this is going online, but that's the way it is, guys, okay? Sorry?
There's women that do it.
Oh, girl, yes. Yes.
Put it in the little box
yes.
in the rabbis.
Yes. So now there are women who do these things, and my daughters will never have to do what I had to do. But when this started becoming popular, a lot of guys were all, they had their panties in a twist, and they were very upset about the idea that these women were, God forbid, helping other women with the laws of ritual purity. And I'm laughing in my mind, I'm like, you do understand what you're saying, right? Like, no. Like you get it? So we wound up writing this huge piece about yoetzot and actually how women are coming back to the mitzvah because they have women to talk to about it. And where a rabbi would get 5 or 6 questions a month, women were getting 5 or 6 questions a day. And there are women who are literally coming back because they were no longer humiliated, no longer had to bring their underwear or their stains to a man, which I think about it now, and I'm like, I cannot believe I did that. Like, what the heck? But at different times. So we wrote this piece, and it was published in Cross Currents. Now, Cross Currents back then was like the Haredi blog in English. And people were mad as hell that Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein let us write in that. Website, because it was really just like rabbis and stuff. But it was the most popular article they'd ever had. And we changed the minds of the admin of Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein, who, to his credit, listened and said out loud and in print, I changed my mind. If these women are actually helping women keep Torah and come back to Judaism, who am I to say no? And for me, that made me understand how vital it is to speak out. It made me realize how women have to be speaking, how women's perspectives must be heard, and we can't be silenced. We can't let them silence us. We have to speak out. So we started writing a lot. And eventually people said, you know, we would like you to come to London. We'd like you to come to England. We'd like to come and talk. And I'm like, you know, I had a job at the time. I was doing websites. I was like with Allison. I was working. I had little kids. And I just kind of said, well, if I'm going to do this, I have to actually start a real organization. And we did. We started Chokhmat Nashim, which means women's wisdom, as you mentioned. And where other organizations focus on, let's say, policy, they try to lobby the Knesset and they try to change laws. Mm-hmm. And there are still other organizations that work in the courts. They represent cases. Like, for example, it is no longer legal to keep women off of political lists. It's not legal to keep women off of political lists. Does anyone know if there are any political lists in this country where no women are allowed?
Yes.
And?
UTJ?
Yes. Both UTJ. UTJ. The two Haredi parties. Yadut Torah. Which is not Otzma Yehudit, that's what's his name. Ben Gvir. No politics. Shas and UTJ, despite it being illegal to keep women off of political parties, they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. So you can win a court case. Mm-hmm. And you can even have legislation that makes something illegal. But in this wonderful country, people break the laws every day and get through with it. Yeah. Okay? So how do they get away with it? They put women on 75 the 75th, they're never going to get to 75, right? Or they put women in or whatever, or they... The list, thank you.
120 seats.
Thank you. Well, yeah. So, we decided we were going to focus on the community. Because really nothing can hold in the community if the community refuses to allow it. And nothing can break into the community if the community says, we will not have this behavior here. And so we focus on educating about get refusal, about educating about the halachic prenup, educating about your rights. I had a woman wrote, it was the most amazing, the most amazing message I got. This woman had been going back and forth, and she's in Lakewood, and she's trying to get a divorce, and he's refusing, and she doesn't know what to do. And I've been giving her advice and trying to help her as much as I can. And she wrote to me like a few weeks ago, and she said, I got my get, you know? And I was like, oh my God! Ah! And she's like, thank you so much, thank you so much. And I was like, I really didn't do anything. She goes, no. You told me I didn't have to accept what they were saying to me. You taught me that I had rights. You gave me the words to say, I deserve, I'm allowed, and you can't take this from me. I was just blown away. Like, blown away that something so basic is so lacking. And that someone can assist someone to change their lives by giving them simply the permission and the words to stand up for themselves. And she actually went, it's a long story. But anyway, the beauty of it is you never know who you're impacting. You never know who you're impacting by speaking out. So we have two particular projects that we work on. One is called RateMyBeitDin.com, which actually... Rate My Rabbinic Court. So outside of Israel, because here in Israel we can't really... It's like Lashon Hara, like left and right. You can't even say I didn't like the pizza because they'll sue you. But outside of Israel, you have a choice of rabbinic courts to go to. Right? You can here. You can't go. Like if you do want to, get a divorce, you have to go to your local court. Outside of Israel, you can go to where you want to go to, and there's so many options. So, yeah, you know what Yelp is.
Yes. Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's like a review site.
But in the Haredi communities, let's just say, you cannot go to another court. If you're Lubavitch, you're going to the Lubavitch Rebbe.
Interesting. I don't really know. Does Chabad have its own divorce courts?
I don't know about Chabad, but Breslov, you know, those kind of things.
I don't know the answer to that 100%. Like, if you're in Muncie, legally, if you live in Muncie, you can still go to Lakewood, or you could still go to wherever to that court legally, because also it's not a federal court or even a state court. It's just a Jewish court. It's a religious court. So we have a whole Beitin system. We have a website. Thank you. That rates Bateidin from surveys. We have over 600 reviews of over 60 courts around the world. Now, why is this important? Number one, there is zero transparency or accountability in the rabbinic court system. Zero. If you go to a court, you don't have any idea how much you're going to pay, how long you're going to wait, who's going to be in that room, what's the procedure is going to be, because they don't tell you. Some of it is simply, you know, you started in a shtetl and you continue to work as if you're in a shtetl, but you can't do that nowadays, right? And some of it is purposeful. It's purposeful. They want to do what they want to do. They want to do how they want to do it, and they don't want anyone to tell them otherwise. Money for sure. And that's not how Judaism works. So, again, people will say, like, who do you think you are? And I'm like, I'm sorry, but they work for us. Like, they're the Beit Din system. That's the court system. We pay them. Like, this is a service. And the funny thing is, you know, as I get older and wiser, I realize there is no Jewish community without Jewish women. What do I mean by that? Guys, there's no future without our uteruses.
That's right.
There is no next generation without us.
So
we could go and marry the Pope.
Oh.
and that child would be Jewish. But if we refuse to get, if we refuse to be with Jewish men because Jewish marriage has become something that is, it's painful for me to say it, but if it has been twisted out of a holy thing and into a trap, all we have to do is say no. And we carry within us the next generation of Jews. And our daughters do. Not even our sons, whom I love. I got three boys. I love them. But at the end of the day, it's my daughters who are bringing the next generation of Jews. So why are we so meek? Why are we not standing up for ourselves and our daughters and our sisters? There's nobody that is more important to the Jewish community than Jewish women. But they don't want us to know that. I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but there's a reason that women are undereducated.
Yeah.
There's a reason that we don't know the sources.
Sure.
There's a reason that we can't pick up the books and say, actually, this is my right, and this is my right, and this is my right, and this is my right. They don't give us that education. And we have to stop that pattern.
Yeah.
We have to insist, religious or not, in this country, if you live here, your kids are getting married according to the Rabbanut. Every girl that goes down under a chuppah is a potential aguna. That's the truth. And we have to protect our daughters. Esther could not leave her marriage. There's one Jew that wasn't saved in Purim. One Jew that was not saved in the Purim story. Esther. She saved everybody else. She was the mother of the Jewish nation for generations to come. We are here because of Esther. But Esther wasn't saved. We cannot allow our daughters to be in that situation. And I say this repeatedly when I talk to the judges. Jewish marriage is supposed to be holy. And Jewish marriage can't be holy if Jewish divorce doesn't have dignity. It's as simple as that. If it's a trap, it's not holy. If it's something that I can not leave of my own free will, that is not a holy thing. And that is not what God intended. How do I know that? Because if you look at the laws, the worst laws, tell me the worst, most difficult law in the Torah that is hard for you as a woman to come to terms with. Touche! Okay.
I don't know if this is halachic, but that a man doesn't have to give a woman the get, but he can remarry someone else.
Yeah, well, a man can have four wives, according to the Torah.
Yeah.
Well, sota.
That's
sota, thank you. What is sota? Sota is the woman who is accused of
adultery.
Right. To be brief about it, in the times of the Torah, a man... I feel bad, you guys can't see me. I'll just stand for a few minutes. In the times of the Torah, a man who thought his wife was stepping out on him, shall we say, was to take her to the Beit HaMikdash, or the Mishkan, depending on the time of the where you were at the time, and have her drink these bitter water. The Kohen took off her headscarf, and she drank bitter waters, and according to the text, her stomach would shrivel and she would die, but really she would go home and either have a baby or eventually suffer for her sins. Now, to us, it's public humiliation. It is degrading and humiliating. But step back one second. What do they do to women they think are adulterers in Saudi Arabia right now? What are they doing in India? In the Middle East,
yes.
Africa, women
yes.
are disposable.
Yeah.
And back then, women were disposable. And a man who was suspicious of his wife could do what he wanted, when he wanted, and no one was going to say boo. Comes the Torah and says, hold up, you're suspicious. Did you warn her? Did you tell her specifically, you, Sarah, can't be with Yankel in a room? You cannot be close with them. Did you warn her? And did a witness see her do it? Did two witnesses see you warn her? And did a witness see her secluded with him? No, can't take her to the Beit HaMikdash. You can't accuse her. What Sota did was take the fate of the woman out of the hands of the man and put her in the hands of God. So if the guy warned her twice in front of two witnesses, and a witness saw her secluded with this guy, Then, and only then, could he take her to the Kohen. And she could leave. She had the choice to say, yeah, I did it. And then she would be divorced and walk away. Mm-hmm. That's it. Nothing happens to her. I did it, she's divorced. She's not beaten, she's not killed, she's nothing. And if she protested her innocence, then she went through the ritual, drank the bitter waters, and went home. And he had to take her back. And if she didn't die...
Innocent.
Mm-hmm. So for us in the 21st century, we're like, oh, what? Mm-hmm. But back then, that was a huge, massive change in women's rights. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Eshet Yifat Tohar, Eshet Yifat Tohar is something that is... It's blood-curdling to us. What does it mean? It means if a guy goes to war and he's overcome with lust, he can take a woman and bring her home with him.
A woman from the enemy.
A woman from the enemy, yes, thank you. And bring her home with him. And we're just like, again, what? But I don't think any of us need to be told after October 7th that this scenario doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And in the Torah, he had to take care of her, he had to bring her home, and he had to marry her. Mm-hmm. He had to let her... And mourn her parents. Again, guys, I'm not saying that this is the most feminist thing out there, but I am trying to just put things into context a little bit. He had to let her mourn her parents. He had to shave her head and grow her nails so that she was no longer attractive, and then say, do you want to be my wife? And if she said no, she went back. So she had the choice. And back then, they simply took people. I mean, they just took them. And they became part of the conquering nation. This is the way the world worked. How do I know that the Torah would not want women to be chained in marriage? Because the Torah shows us that abuse is not our way. Mm-hmm. And that Jewish marriage, a man is supposed to give sexual relations and food and clothing and shelter. And if a man isn't living with his wife, but rather extorting her, he's not doing any of that. So this isn't really Jewish marriage. And I'll give you one more story. I once went to a very, very, very well-known rabbi in America who is... one of the good guys. And I wanted him to talk about get refusal and things like that and agunot. And he said, let me tell you a story. And I'll make this story very short. He said, there was a young woman who came to me. 2 weeks into her marriage, her husband was clearly gay. Mm. He wouldn't be with her. He was gay. She didn't know what to do. Mm. He's sitting there. I said, oh, great. You can halachically free her. In halacha, that's a clear hafgat kiddushin. It... Kiddushin, bitul kiddushin.
No.
Right, but it's the closest translation, but really we say void. Because an annulment is...
Catholic.
The rabbis will give you a hard time if you say annulment. So just say void. A voided marriage, because it never really happened, because it was false pretenses, let's say. He went on to tell me how he went to 3 experts in homosexuality to find out if it's possible that the guy had been gay before he got married, because they knew he was gay in high school, it all came out later. Mm-hmm. Not gay when he married her, and then gay again. And 2 of them said no, that it's not possible. If you're gay, you're gay. And one of them said yes. And on the basis of the one who said yes, he kept her married to him.
No.
Yes.
And this is a good rabbi?
Rabbi Willig, I'll just say it. Rabbi Willig. He told me this story to my face. To my face.
Who, the Willig.
Mordechai Willig. No, the rabbi told me that. So he said, I said, well, why would you do that? Like, this is clear grounds for getting her out of this marriage. Why would you keep her in this marriage? You know what he said to me? We don't end Jewish marriage so quickly.
Uh-oh.
And I said,
marriage.
This is what you call Jewish marriage? Mm-hmm. In that moment, okay. I stopped counting on rabbis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Done. That's not to say that there aren't good rabbis. There are great rabbis. There are tzaddikim who actually help women in these situations. I know 3 amazing, amazing rabbis here in this country who have saved women in far, more complex situations, who already have children but needed to get out of the marriage. But my point is, I stopped waiting for Mashiach to come from the rabbis, is what I'm saying. And I realized, you know what? Whatever I can do, Hashem knows my heart. Whatever I can do, I'm going to do. So we have ranked my Beit Din, and we have seen change from it. We have seen they don't like being ranked. Okay, they don't like being judged. The judges don't like being judged. I'm just saying. They don't like it. And there are, I have sat across the table from, I sat across the table from rabbis in America 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago I was in the States. And I said to them, well, what happens when you tell a guy he has to give a get and he refuses? And he goes, well, there's like nothing worse that you can do to me than go, I can't handle it. It's like, I can't. Not my kids, not a rabbi, I can't take it. It's like, what does that mean? So I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, it's out of my hands. And I said, well, you're a rabbinic leader and you are part of the OU and the RCA. Like, you are our people. You are supposed to be the leadership here. And he said, but if I start advocating for this, you know, for women to get, he's like, I'll be seen as feminist. You know, I sat there for an hour and a half with him. Nobody said the word feminist but him. So I said to him, I said, why is advocating for a divorce when divorce is warranted seen as a feminist thing? He goes, I don't know. I go, maybe this is part of the problem. Maybe this is part of the problem. Why, when a marriage is over, is implementing that law seen as feminist? And not only seen as feminist, but seen as something bad for a judge to do. Blew my mind, and not in a good way. And I said, you know, I'm asking, we're going to leave this meeting, and I'm asking you to think about that. I'm just going to ask you to sit with that and think about what you said to me. Because I can tell you're not comfortable with that. And maybe that's something we can work on together. I haven't followed up with him yet. Guys, it's really hard to like say like things that you think are just supposed to be like move on, may I love, like understood from the beginning and...
common sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And you're just like, okay. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said... There's a documentary, if you haven't seen this documentary on her life, you must. She said that most of her career she spent as a kindergarten teacher. She said she spent most of her time explaining to men why women not having equal rights was a bad thing. She said it much better than I said it, but I was like, oh my God, I relate to you so much right now. I understand you. I feel very much that some, it's like, I have written probably close to 400 articles about the same three topics. Yeah. Anyway, so we have Rate My Beit Din. We are making change. And God willing, for this Yom HaGunah, which is supposed to be in about 12 days, and hopefully it'll be ready, we have statistics coming out for the first time ever. Because what happens inevitably when I talk about this, people say, well, how big of a crisis is it really? How many women are really aguno? You know, I always get that question. And it's not something you can answer for many reasons. I have a lot of articles you can read if you want to understand it, but basically a woman is not considered an aguna or aguna, same word but different accent, until a court, the judges, tell her husband he has to give the get and he refuses. And they call him out on his refusal. Okay, all of that has to happen in order for her to be counted as an aguna. So my aunt, who was an aguna for 14 years, why? I count her as an aguna for 14 years because she asked 14 years ago for a divorce, and he said no. To me, that is quite clearly someone who is being refused to get. But she wasn't because he never showed up for court. So they couldn't give him the chiyuv to do the divorce. And by the way, a lot
that
of women.
Should be reason enough.
Yeah, for sure, of course. A lot of women, by the way, close their cases because in order to keep your case open in the court, you have to pay money. So guys not showing up, why are you putting money in? So they're not counted. Women are not counted. Women who are abused are not counted if the judge says go back. So you have to understand that there's and it's the wrong question to ask. Because every Jewish woman is a potential aguna. How many agunot? Millions. Why? Because we're all in precarious situation. And that has to change. And it's so easy. We're not talking about change. My favorite. After this, my favorite is, can change halacha. Dude, I'm not asking you to change halacha, okay, Moses? Calm down. What I'm saying to you is, let's implement what we actually have already. Let's sign the halachic prenup, and let's just teach our children that refusing a get is as unkosher as pork. Would your child eat pork?
No.
Okay, I'm not asking you actually, but I'm saying, like, some of them might, that's fine. But my point is, would anyone deny that pork isn't kosher? No, pork isn't kosher. That's just what it is. You can eat it, I don't care. Have layers of it and fry it. But the point is, no one's going to say that it's kosher. And I want people to understand that get denial is just like pork. It's just not kosher. That's it, guys. It's not so hard. We can end this. We can end it. We don't have to change nothing. We don't have to decree anything. We don't have to get 70 men together to do a hallelujah. All we have to do is to get the Jewish community to understand that get refusal isn't kosher. Have your children sign the prenup. Tell your friends and family. We can make it a whole party. Actually, I have done post-nup party. We should do a post-nup party with you guys.
I was going to ask about
that. Yes, I signed one. I said to my husband, we have to sign a halachic post-nup. He's like, why? I said,
he was joking, right?
Yeah. It's the same thing as a prenup, but you sign it after you're married.
Ah, like you can still make a prenup.
Yeah, you can still do it. So I like shy. I advocate all the time for prenups. And people ask me if I sign one, and I say, no, it's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't. So we're going to sign one. So then my in-laws were visiting. So my in-laws signed, and we signed. It was very cute. Like, three generations signed, because my son also signed. And we had a whole party in Beit Shemesh, and it was very, very cute. We were in the newspaper. But that's something so easy to do, to get all your friends together, have some cheese and wine, sign the documents, hold it up, smile, and make it a regular, normal part of marriage. Right? We can do that.
If she asks for Shalom Bayit, does that mean he has to come back?
If she asks?
Yeah. Let's say she comes back.
Usually...
In a reverse situation,
yes.
Says, I want Shalom Bayit. You're in Thailand. I don't know where he is with another
right.
woman. Would he come back?
Is would he?
I mean, no. Would the court...
Demand.
Demand him to come back?
They could.
And
in
he
this,
doesn't?
In
so
this,
this
country...
Situation,
in this, there's a set, there's,
but it's only here in Israel, right?
Well, what I was going to say, here in Israel, the court actually has teeth. Meaning it has,
balls.
No, it has legal, I mean, yes, but it's legal ramifications because it is a state institution. So for example, when the court works properly and the court says you have to give a divorce and he says no, the court can sanction him here in this country. Take away his license, freeze his bank account, and not let him out of the country and jail him.
Wow.
They can do
wow.
these things. They don't do them often enough. That's the problem.
And in the States, it's different.
In the States, they don't have any legal authorities.
The Beit Din doesn't have any legal authorities?
No. So there is, when the rabbi goes like this, there's an aspect of it that isn't wrong. Meaning he's like, I don't have legal authority. Yeah, okay, you don't have legal authority, but can you be creative? Does he have a job? Does he have a business?
Does he have a place in the business?
Wait,
but
he
called up.
Nahum? Exactly. Why is he being allowed into a minion? Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. 100%. They don't enforce any of this stuff because they don't want to be feminist.
Is there a difference whether you're married here
yes.
or in the States? Sure. So once you're married here, you're doomed?
No.
No, it's the same thing. It's only where you ask for the divorce.
Okay. So if you're married here, you have to...
Go to bed.
You have to get your divorce here, or at least have it recognized here. Okay?
You can't have it.
Ironically, we're better off here than in America or in Galut because the courts actually can do something, okay, if we can make them do something. So I'll give you an example. There was, I forget her name, unfortunately, because my head is now filled with hostage names, but there was a woman whose husband tried to kill her.
Yeah.
She was in the hospital for 9 months, completely sliced up. I'm not being this 100% fact.
Here in Israel. Not too long ago.
No, she was killed, unfortunately. She was killed. But a few years back, she survived. And the guy, I'm so proud I didn't curse, the guy actually had the nerve when she recovered enough
to
get out of the hospital and ask for a divorce. Because you have to understand, here in Israel, if you don't get divorced, you're legally connected. You have bank accounts together, you have children together, you have to get a divorce in order to not be legally connected to that person. So she gets out of the hospital, first thing she does is try to divorce the man who tried to kill her, and he says no.
Shira.
Something, yes.
Yeah.
And so Mevoi Satum had the case, it was another organization that had the case, and basically we arranged for protests outside the court that we said, Yashar Letzinuk, straight to isolation. Tzinuk is solitary confinement. There is no, you don't pass go, you don't collect $200, get your ass to solitary confinement, or we're losing it. And because there was so much media around this case, because he had literally tried to kill her, and then had the chutzpah to not ask her to not give her a divorce, so the judges knew, everyone's watching them, and immediately said, you either give her a divorce now, or we are putting you in solitary confinement. Until you do. And he did. So the court has the power to do it. They have the power. They just don't really do it very often. But this case was like, it was not even an option. So to answer your question, what was your question?
Is it better to be married here or in Venice?
Where is the better?
Cyprus? Cyprus is where to go.
Yeah. Wondering. I mean,
it's not, listen.
I did get married here, but I'm just like, that's like, not that I'm planning anything, but this is crazy.
It is crazy. It's very scary, and we have to address it. Like, we have to address it. Listen.
I don't think it matters where you get married. It's where you're living when this is happening.
If you are married here, though, you're registered here married.
Okay.
So if you don't get divorced, and meaning if you don't get divorced here or register your divorce here, let's say you get divorced in Manhattan, whatever reason, you still have to register your divorce here. The Rabbanut has to accept it.
When you make Aliyah, you have to register your divorce.
Yes.
I think it depends where you live, because where I was living for about 30 years, the rabbi who was a set of kedushin for two daughters of mine would not perform the marriage unless they signed a prenup.
Where?
Highland Park, New Jersey.
Yeah. That's why. So the RCA technically, RCA is the Rabbinic Council of America, technically has the position that they won't marry anyone without a halachic prenup. However, unfortunately, many of the rabbis don't hold by that, meaning they don't actually enforce it. But yes, they should. And that, again, that's another step that we can take. Again, we don't have to touch halacha.
Is there anybody who doesn't hold by the halachic prenup? I mean, you have one, yet they won't grant you the get.
The Rabbanut here does not like halachic prenups. However, they are getting there, and they worked with Yad LeIsha. Yad LeIsha is an amazing organization. Allison, would you mind taking a picture, by the way? Thank you. I was told my social media team said, if you don't take a picture, you're in trouble. Okay, great. Thank you. I don't know what made me think of it, but Yad LeIsha is an amazing organization that works and represents women who are getting divorced and being denied a divorce for free. It's part of Or Torah Stone, Rav Riskin's, and they created a halachic prenup with the input of the Beit Din, of the Rabbanut. So if you're going to do any and hope that it sticks, I would do the one from Yad LeIsha. Tzohar also has one. I'm a little bit less enamored by it because it really enforces counseling, and a woman who's been abused does not really need to sit with her abuser longer and hear him spew his stuff, you know, his garbage. But if you're, it's better than nothing. Meaning, definitely sign the Tzohar one. If people are insisting on the Tzohar one, just sign the Tzohar one. But Yad LeIsha.
But is that recognized by the Rabbanut, the Tzohar one?
The problem is that the Rabbanut will come and say that they have a position that a prenup makes it even harder for them to get a divorce done. I've had a conversation with Lau about it. You're just talking in circles. It doesn't really make much sense. And I can't explain a position that I don't really understand because it doesn't really make sense to me. And I don't mean halachically. I mean logically. It doesn't make sense to me. Sorry?
Sorry, weren't there prenups in the Middle Ages?
Yes. This is not a new concept. This is 100% not a new concept. It's as old as Rambam.
I think they're part of the documents from the Cairo Geniza.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Mm-hmm. Very, very fascinating ones, actually. Yeah. Well, let me just tell you, and then you can all take questions. I also have a website called Jewish Life Photos. Jewish Life Photo Bank? JewishLifePhotoBank.com.
Jewish Life?
JewishLifePhotoBank.com. It's over 2,000 images of Jewish women, couples, girls, families, real people. Our models are all volunteer. You guys can volunteer for our next photo shoot if you want to. Because either the Orthodox magazines don't have any images because they erase women, mm-hmm. or the media doesn't have any, because if you Google Orthodox woman, you're going to find a nun, and you're going to find a woman in a hijab, and you're going to find, you know, like sister wives, but you're not going to find Orthodox women because we don't exist because nobody uses our images. So now we exist in the photo bank, and I'm pleased to say that the media, at least the Jewish media at the moment, the Jerusalem Post and the UK Jewish Chronicle and Times of Israel all subscribe and use our images. I'm trying to get to like Getty Images. But I can't, the problem is, because everyone's a volunteer model, I can't just put it on iStock. Right. Because then it could use it for nefarious reasons. And I promised my models, my volunteer models, that I would protect them. So I'm trying to get Getty to use them with our terms, but in any case, we have it, it exists, and I think the importance of this project is that it does exist. And the importance of this project is to renormalize seeing Orthodox families and women in normal situations. Two responses that I got really hit home to me the importance of this project. One was from a totally secular guy who was my Olpan teacher. And he's like, wow, Shoshana, you totally, in Hebrew, says me, you totally changed my image of a religious woman. He's like, I never thought, like, you guys are playing tennis and you're like holding hands with your husbands. He's like, I never saw such a thing. He's like, thank you for like showing me that this is your community. And the other was actually a religious woman who was one of our volunteers. And when she's looking at the pictures of herself and of other people, we put it in the calendar, and she's like crying, and she's like, I can't believe how they made me so used to not seeing women in the media. Wow. Me. She's like, this is so beautiful. I can't believe how we've just gone along with it. And so it's vital. And, you know, God willing, when we have more money, we'll be able to, my PR is my problem with that, because it's just a lot of money to advertise these things. So God willing. I don't remember anything else I was supposed to say, so I'm open for questions. Yeah, I'll let go.
This is a topic, the Adonai topic, it's also very close to me, knowing people, etc. And I asked the Rav in my community, I said, we say Shabbat in Beit Knesset, tefillah for people that are sick, for chayalim, for the medina. Why don't we say a tefillah for the agunot? And then we're teaching, it exists, but why don't we say it publicly, say it once a month, say it certain times? I said, I can't go ahead and change anything. And he's a Rav who's actually out of the box. But I am with you, and I'm a volunteer as of this moment, because I...
Awesome.
Yeah, Center for Women's Jewish Justice. I mean, all these, I'm outraged as an educated Jewish woman that we're sitting in this situation today. And as you said, I think we have to be doing something.
100%. Listen, I mean, just to bring in current events, because how do we not bring in current events? I don't think we need anything that past October 7th to understand how vital it is to not allow women's voices to not be heard. I mean, the entire tragedy could have been avoided if women were listened to.
Absolutely.
And the concept that we're just ignoring that, or like putting it to the side, that should be shouted from every single parapet, from every pulpit. If not listening to women caused October 7th.
Absolutely.
That's it. Mm-hmm. So how do we do tshuva? How do we not? You listen to women. You listen to the perspectives of women. You put women in the war cabinet. You put women in the other cabinet. You stop banning women from... This has to be something that we are shouting 24/7. And I do not care if they call you a feminist or if they call you a loud woman or an angry woman or whatever it is, because, honey, what do they say? Polite women never made history. Something like that, right? Whatever. We can't shut us up. Any other questions?
I have a question about the secular courts, because if, as you were saying, like there are financial ramifications, there are things that can be done. What role do the secular courts have in enforcing some of these issues when there is a man who is a refuser?
When you say secular, you mean in Israel?
Yeah, in Israel, yeah.
None.
What?
Divorce, okay, it's a throwback to the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire's rules of life were that the Christians went to Christian court and the Muslims went to Sharia court and the Jews went to the Beit Din. When it comes to religious matters, divorce is a religious matter. The only time you can bring in a civil court, I think is the right term, the civil court for a divorce is Susan Weiss of Center for Women's Justice had created tort cases, meaning a man who was refusing could be sued for damages for inflicting pain and suffering.
Yep.
And using that, they leveraged it. Yep. So most often, the man would just give the get and not the damages. But there was a case where the guy would rather pay the damages and keep her chained. Mm-hmm. So the civil court cannot divorce you. It doesn't have the power to grant a divorce.
But it can implement the tools of the pressure. Like
no, the Beit Din does it. The Beit Din.
But why can't the civil court do that?
Because the case is not in the civil court in that regard.
But you could bring it if you do it as damages or something.
Only if you do it as damages. Yeah. Because there's a divide. Mm-hmm. Marriage, divorce, burial, it's all in the Rabbanut. Mm-hmm. It's all in the Rabbanut. And there's no civil marriage. The only way you can get around marriage, religious marriage here, is if you do what's called, I guess in America, it's a civil law marriage.
Common law marriage.
And here it's called Yadua B'tzibur, right, which means you are announcing yourselves as a couple, but you're not halachically married.
Right, like you go to Greece and get married and you come.
No.
No.
It's common law.
If you live with someone in the eyes of the community after a certain amount of time, you guys are married.
Right. But
does that require a divorce?
That's the question. There are still some people who will say, if you're common law married or you do a B'tzibur for over a certain amount of years, you have to get a get anyway. I don't have as much experience with that, but yeah.
All right. I wanted to tell you that when my kids started getting married, and that was around 2000. So not only they and the future in-laws. And the rabbis that they used, but a lot of their friends insisted, it was built in to the ceremony, that the rabbi insisted on a prenup.
Mm-hmm.
And we had really never heard of it.
Highland Park.
And my sons went into the marriage.
Right. Right.
So I was very, and two of them were doctors, so I was really, really very happy that they were being protected, and so were the women, and Baruch Hashem, they're still all together. But my grandchildren are getting married now, and four of them will be married here in Israel. Two of them are already married.
Mazel tov.
Thank you. So I don't know anything about Israeli marriages.
I'm very happy to. First of all, on our website, we have an entire page dedicated to resources for this, so you can look
and
up.
And you are at
Here, I'm going to make it really easy. Ready?
Okay, good.
One of the things I didn't talk about because whatever, lots to talk about, is as part of fighting the erasure of women and of raising the perspectives of women, we created. Someone asked me. People always ask me these questions. Where can I get posters of women? Where can I get posters of the Imahot? Where can I get that? I'm like, okay, so I'll Google that for you. And and I didn't find any sets of educational posters of our prophetesses or our mothers or blah, blah, blah. So we made it. So we commissioned 10 pieces of art. I'll give you that. 10 pieces of art from 8 different artists, female artists. And they got to choose who they wanted to represent. And we sell these. We sell these posters, canvases. You can do it for a bat mitzvah gift. You can do it for your sukkahs. It's Nechama Leibovitz, who's a scholar. Sure. Then there's Ruth, Miriam, Esther, Yehudit.
We've had them in the sukkah.
Yeah?
How long have they been out?
2 years. Okay. Yael, Devora, Chana Senish, Dana Gracia, Bruria, and... That's it, that's 10. So on the website, chokhmatnashim.org, you can both shop for this and see the prenup resource page. So I'm just going to pass these around. Okay.
And your, and
I
your
there should
site
be one for everybody.
Is there in case we want to make an.
And yes, you can absolutely donate.
The second
can you take one and pass it?
So Shona, if you have
is the post
resources there
too?
You want to give me, like websites?
I'll give you everything you want.
Pass them along.
Absolutely.
Is the postnup also mentioned there?
Yes. So the postnup is the prenup. The prenup is the postnup. We just sign it, married.
It's the same thing.
And yes, it's the same thing. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Have you had United places since the beginning of the war where soldiers have been killed and they can't find the bodies? And what do the women do? Is it, this is
I, actually, I actually can tell you something worse than that. Okay. Does anyone know what yibum is?
Yes.
Okay. Yibum is
when
you a woman is married to a man and they do not have children, his brother is obligated to marry her.
If she dies.
If he dies without children.
Said that part. He dies without children. It's root.
Root.
So, unfortunately, in this war, we've had young men die who do not have children. And their widows have had to do chalitza. Now, yibum is not practiced anymore. We don't have brother-in-laws marrying their brother's widows, but you do chalitza. Chalitza is, talk about a denigrating ceremony. She spits in the shoe. He takes off his shoe. Actually, there's a special shoe in the rabbanut that they use, and there's a special room. And she spits in the shoe because he says, I won't marry you. And she says, marry me. And he says, I won't marry you. And it's a whole degrading ceremony. And it was a dilemma in the past year. Do I write about this? Do I talk about this or not?
Does this happen at the Beit Din?
Yes. Yeah. Not only does it happen at the Beit Din, but what the Beit Din would do, because it's a rare thing. You've been to teaching hospitals? You know, your legs are up in stirrups and like... Yeah. 50 men come in, or 50 dogs, I shouldn't say men, 50 students come in, and
yes.
You're just like, what?
Yeah.
And they're just like, well, it's a teaching hospital. You're like, oh, okay. And, you know. So, unfortunately, yes. And unfortunately, in the Rabbanut, they would have rabbinic students come and watch these ceremonies without really considering the fact that this woman is not only in mourning for her dead husband, but going through a ceremony that is pasha humiliating. And so Itim, just to give a plug to another organization, Rabbi Seth Barber, went out of their way to find these women and say to the Rabbanut, we have to do this in a very tsanua, the least degrading way possible for these young widows who have just lost their husbands in this war.
How soon do you have to be done? Do you have to do this? How soon do you have to do this?
Well, you have to wait 90 days to make sure she's not expecting.
Right.
And I don't know if there is some sort of time limit. I don't know if it's 6 months or 9 months or something like that, but it's not, but it's quite soon. Yeah. And so to answer your question, there's not really women who are agunot because the Rabbanut has, to their credit, gone out of its way to analyze videos and DNA and to make sure that no woman is left without knowing the fate of her husband.
Now, when he's dead. There's a question.
When he's dead. Yeah.
What happens? The Rabbanut has declared someone dead.
Yeah.
We get back someone who's not dead, but they've already given a get. What happens?
Well, they don't give a get. They declare them
dead.
They
just declare them dead.
Yeah.
But then she could be married.
In theory, but they're very, very careful. They've been great in this war to really analyze and work with the IDF and the Shabak and whatever and the forensics, to not declare someone dead unless they can really. I think they require three different
sources.
Confirmation.
Yeah, but also the flip side is to not wait because. It's just not, you know.
Make the pain and suffering.
Yeah, so they have been very good in that regard to give them
but
credit.
But this all started from the World Trade Center, didn't it? With
what?
The declaring people dead even though they didn't have bodies. And
it started
stuff like
with
that.
World War I or II.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's not my area of expertise, but I do know that those are the issues that we've been dealing with this war specifically.
I think that most girls don't need to know that they need to do chalitza. The girls who are...
How would they know?
How would they know? Nobody, we never...
Nobody talks about this.
So does the rabbi find these girls to tell them?
Yeah.
Can you say, do you feel like you're making an impact? I mean, what's happening?
Yes. So, you know, with Rate My Beit Din, there's no question. I've met with Dayanim. We see that they are scrambling to... Look, some, again, are just who they are, right? Like, until they... You shine a light on a problem, so they don't. So now they have the process on site. They have the fees on site. They have procedures, exactly what's going to go down. And some of them have even implemented evaluations afterwards, which is really, really important.
Wow.
Because it's very hard to self-evaluate. But if someone who goes through your court, and they have to feel safe, right? They can't feel like anything they say is going to be used against them somehow. So they're implementing evaluations. So in that regard, yes. We also have, where I really feel the difference or making a difference is in the people that contact me, right? So like if it's the woman who says, I got my get, and this, that's not meaning, that's the most recent one, but I've, numerous women have said to me, thank you for suggesting this, thank you for telling me that, thank you for writing and just letting me know. Because again, if you don't put this out there in the world, it's not there. And I think that's the thing that I realize the most. Like, if you don't see it, what do they say? If you don't see it, you can't be it. Right? Like, and they usually say about girls. Like, if you don't show girls, they can be doctors. You don't show girls, they can be whatever. They don't know it. But it's really true in everything. And if we make, if we allow Judaism to be a society where girls are told what to do and told to trust blindly, which is what we're all taught. I mean, at the end of the day, we're all taught to trust blindly, to trust the rabbis blindly. It was extremely painful for me. When I got married, I'm so stupid. When I got married, my rabbi was 6'7". And my mother-in-law, wasn't my mother-in-law at the time, but she was about to be my mother-in-law, she said, you should sign a prenup. I didn't know what that was. So I went to my rabbi and I said, should I sign a prenup? And he goes, ah, what do you need that for? I'll break his knees. Direct quote. Direct quote. He was 6'7". I was an idiot. And he said, I'll break his knees. I didn't know what he was talking about. I obviously was deeply in love with my husband, who was the best guy in the world. And so I didn't sign a prenup. But now, I am fully aware of how grossly irresponsible that was of him to say to me. Grossly irresponsible. Oh, you're going to come wherever I am, whatever point in my life, and break his knees. Really?
I remember saying that to you.
Did you contact him afterwards?
You know, I didn't.
You should.
I should. But
by the way,
I realize that we're just told to trust. And we do.
That has to change.
Also, I had a kid 9.5 months later because he said, what do you need birth control for? So now my younger children like to tease my eldest that he was a total accident. Which he was, but no, listen, I'm lucky that my husband's a great guy, but that was a really rough year. I deserved to have time with my husband. I deserved to learn to be a couple before I was nauseous and in bed rest. And I almost had a baby 7 months after we got married because I was having early contractions. He's like, you cannot have this baby 7 months after we got married. I am not in control of this. But he waited to come out. But I just think, you know, if we're going to have a healthy, stable Judaism that we can all want to pass down, then we have to be active. I feel very strongly that we become super passive. Someone else tells us what's kosher. Someone else tells us where to send our kids. Someone else tells us what to do for Pesach. You know, every once a year, we just ask the rabbi, how do I do my sink again? And what do I do? We're so passive. And we get used to being dependent. And we get used to being told. And so then we just say, well, what can I do? Because I'm used to that passive position. And Judaism is such an active religion, mm-hmm. right? Like, we have how many positive commandments? Like 248 or something? And like we are supposed to be doing. And I feel very strongly that making the community better, stronger, healthier, responsible, just, there's a word I'm looking for, but I can't find it. That's our responsibility. And it's hard, guys, like we're living a war. We're living in trauma. We're living in uncertainty. We're living in pain. There's no question. And none of us can do this by ourselves. And none of us, I don't even have the energy to do like, I don't even know what, let alone fix Judaism. But if we all do what we can do in our own homes and in our own communities, and we all say, okay, you know what, I could take this on. This I can do. I can have a post-nup party. I can pose for the pictures. I can boycott a magazine that doesn't show women. I can vote for the Haredi lady, even though I'm not Haredi, because I want her voice to be heard on the city council. These are important things that will make a big difference. And each one of us can pick up that baton in our own lives. Everyone in this room has a role to play. That is my message, my takeaway message for you. And thank you so much for coming to me.
Are you related to Aubrey Driscoll?
He's my father-in-law.
Get out of here. I know you.
He's my father-in-law.
He was my neighbor in Elizabeth.
Oh, good guy.
Oh, good guy. Oh, lovely man. Yeah.
Yes.
I always wanted to do this thing where I call the people who have the time. I'm a
my kind of business. I do advertise.
There's a circular that they made.